From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Just about everybody knows part of Pat Tillman's story, the former pro football player from the South Bay who gave up his multi-million dollar career to enlist in the Army. You probably know that Tillman was killed in Afghanistan, and you may well know something about the controversy surrounding his death. But it has taken years for the entire Pat Tillman story to unfold. Indeed, it is unfolding still. Now, a powerful new documentary called The Tillman Story knits together what we know and what we don't know about what happened to Pat Tillman and why. Next on Forum, we'll hear clips from the film and talk with the director of The Tillman Story. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When pro football star Pat Tillman left the NFL and joined the Army Rangers, it was a big story. And when he was killed in Afghanistan, it became even bigger news. But Tillman's death wasn't the last chapter in his extraordinary tale. The Army first said Tillman died in a Taliban ambush, declared him a hero, and awarded him the Silver Star. But then the Tillman story veered from the predicted script. Belatedly, the Army acknowledged that Tillman was instead the victim of friendly fire. But that didn't end the story either. Indeed, Pat Tillman's story is both inspirational and inexplicable. It includes both extraordinary family determination and incomprehensible deceit. And the story, with all its twists and turns, is now the subject of a powerful new documentary called The Tillman Story, which opens today in the Bay Area in Berkeley, San Francisco, and San Jose. It's directed by Amir Barlev, who joins us now. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
It's a terrific film, and it's a really remarkable story. So let's begin. Although most everyone has heard at least a little bit of the Pat Tillman story, its beginning, its middle, perhaps some of how it ended. Tell me a little first about who he was, the kind of person he was.
Well, it's tough to sum him up in sound bites, and I think that's been one of the problems. But he was a complex guy, and he was a guy who was multifaceted. He was patriotic. He came from a family that had served in the military all the way back to the Civil War. But he was a critical thinker, and he was a fan of Noam Chomsky's. He was a fan of Emerson's. He was an avid reader. He
outstanding was, student at Arizona State.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, he was a guy who had very strong beliefs but was always challenging those beliefs. In fact, his family says that was one of his greatest qualities, was that he was constantly trying to argue both sides of a story, of a position. He was a guy who, you know, in a few years ago would have been labeled as a flip-flopper. He wasn't the square-jawed kind of paragon of moral certitude that he was made out to be. Far from it. He was a guy with doubts and a guy who could change his mind.
So he was a star athlete, of course, played at Arizona State, where he was not only a star athlete, he was also an academic All-American. Went on to a professional football career playing for the Arizona Cardinals for 4 years. And then 9/11 happened. And let's listen to one clip from your film, which is an interview that he gave right after 9/11, sometime before he actually wound up joining the Army. But let's hear what Pat Tillman had to say just a day or so after 9/11.
Even as athletes, we bitch and moan every now and again about this or that. And if we ever just, you know, times like this, you stop and think about just how, not only how good we have it, but what kind of a system we live under, what freedoms were allowed. And that wasn't built overnight, and it's kind of, the flag is a symbol of all that, a symbol of, you know, you just don't think about it all the time.
So reflections indicating the kind of patriotism that you were just describing, Amir, and that sort of, do you have a sense, because he never really came out and said, I'm going to join the Army because, that's the closest we know to some of his thinking. But walk us through what you think might have been going on with him in that time after 9/11, leading up to his decision to drop his football career.
That's a fascinating chapter in the film, I think. The way that interview was used, and actually I shouldn't even call it an interview because it really wasn't an interview. He emphatically decided not to do any interviews. He didn't want to talk about his reasons for enlisting. And at first, the media, you know, who was so hungry for a story, kind of begrudgingly praised him, you know, and said, "Well, he's like a figure out of the Greatest Generation. He, you know, he's got that Greatest Generation modesty," even though it meant that they weren't going to get their, you know, their story. He steadfastly refused to talk about it. And then when he died, that interview that you just played was dug up. It was, as you mentioned, it was recorded in the hours. It was like less than 24 hours after the planes hit the towers. And you can remember how you felt, how all of us felt after that. He was emotional. But the thing about it is that only one part of that interview actually got excerpted. The part that you played is the part that most people are familiar with. Not seconds after that, he did what I was talking about earlier, what he was kind of famous for. He flip-flopped, you know, he said, you know, but having said all that, you know I just said that football seems so stupid right now, but the next words out of his mouth were, you know, having said that, I want to go out and play. You never hear that part of the interview because it was shunted off to the sides, like so many parts of his personality, in order to create this idea of a guy who, you know, takes off his helmet and shouts, "Osama bin Laden, I'm coming to get you," after 9/11. But then even after he says both of those things, he says, you know, "I find myself talking in circles here." He actually didn't want to. It's pretty interesting looking at the raw tape there, because he didn't really want to be having this conversation right after 9/11. It was too emotional.
Amir Bar-Lev, our guest this hour. He's the director of a new film called The Tillman Story. So he went through this time afterwards, mulling this over, in the end decided, along with his brother Kevin, to join the Army. Tell us what happened next, where he was sent, what happened to him during his Army service.
Well, the first chapter was that while he was still in training, we started talking about going into Iraq. And this was very disappointing to those guys, to himself and to his brother, because they had expected to go to Afghanistan. So, and sure enough, their first tour of duty was sent. They were sent to Iraq, and you know, from very, very early on, he began to be disillusioned with the kind of orders and the kind of mission that they were on.
How do we know that, Amir?
Because his very first combat mission was the so-called rescue of Jessica Lynch. It's a great coincidence of history. And Pat was such a prescient and insightful guy that while he was sitting there, this is even before there were any news reports about Jessica Lynch, even the bogus news reports that, you know, that first came out, he was sitting there on the ground saying, "This is BS. You know, this is a pageant." And he said, he even said to his friend who's in our film, "If I die, they're going to do the same thing to me."
Jessica Lynch, of course, was the 19-year-old, I think it was, from West Virginia, who was part of a story that the Army really concocted, that she heroically fired her gun until there were no more bullets, when in fact she didn't fire any at all and could easily have been rescued without the group of people, including Pat Tillman, who came to her rescue.
And the reason the Jessica Lynch fib or stunt worked for a while is the same reason that the Pat Tillman fib worked, which is they both reminded people of movie characters. You know, Jessica Lynch was called the female Rambo, and Pat Tillman had this kind of John Wayne persona. The press played right along with both stories because it sells better shampoo. You know, I mean, when you tell somebody this is a real live story that just is from Hollywood, people tune in, and they, you know, and that's why the government's stunt worked so well.
So after his first tour, he went back home for a while, and then he went back for a second tour of duty in Afghanistan this time. We'll talk a little bit later in the program about that, the tumultuous events that ended with his death in Afghanistan. But before we go through all of that, he was killed in April of 2004. And what was the story that was first told about his death? What was his family told? What happened in the way in which that story was first reported?
I'm so glad you asked that, because it's one of the great misperceptions out there to this day. The first story was a John Wayne story. It was that he died storming a hill, saving the life of his entire platoon. He went down in a hail of Taliban gunfire, and he could be heard saying, "Let's take the fight to the enemy. you know, were some of his last words, which coincidentally was one of the talking points of the Bush administration at the time. You know, let's take the fight over there, not here. So, you know, it's clear that a bunch of PR agents at the Army had concocted this.
And that story was actually told at his memorial service.
That story was—
How did that come about? Do you have a sense of how that story got created?
It was, well, it was concocted by the Army, possibly in some ways in cahoots with the White House, and then it was disseminated. And one of the things they did was they gave it to a friend of the family's, a Navy SEAL, who was there to deliver a eulogy, and they slipped him that story and had him deliver the lie, you know, unwittingly to the American people. But the thing that people don't understand is, and when people talk about the film often, they say, you know, 5 weeks later it was revealed that in fact the truth came out. It's not the truth has not yet come out. That's something I really have to underline, because 5 weeks later, the government realized they couldn't get away with this lie. Now they had a problem on their hands. 600 of Pat's battalion mates were rotating back to the United States. So now not only did they have to kind of come clean, because everybody in Afghanistan knew, all the soldiers knew that this was – that it had been friendly fire. But they also had to explain why they said this bogus story to begin with. So they came up with a pretty good sham, and it's worked till this day. And the sham is, everything we told you about Pat's heroism happened. But we just finished an investigation and we found out that he happened to be killed by an errant U.S. bullet. So that's how most people think of this today. They think there was a fog of war and Pat was killed, you know, in the confusion of combat. And that's not the case.
One of the things that becomes clear watching your documentary is how the story continues to unfold even now, and that there are just different chapters, and that there is no, in effect, real definitive ending to this. But as you say, 5-6 weeks after his death, the friendly one version of the friendly fire story was revealed to the family. Let's hear another clip from the film now. What you're going to hear in this clip is first President Bush talking about Pat Tillman, and then you'll hear Pat Tillman's mother talking about her discovery that there was more going on than the family initially knew.
Courageous and humble, a loving husband and son, a devoted brother, and a fierce defender of liberty, Pat Tillman will always be remembered.
I think they just thought if they spun the story and we found out, we'd just keep it quiet because we wouldn't want to diminish his heroism or anything like that. But, you know, nobody questions Pat's heroics. He was always heroic. What they said happened didn't happen. They made up a story. And so you have to set the record straight.
Pat Tillman's mother, Danny, Mary, I guess, is her given name, but goes by Danny, who's one of the real heroines of this story, who diligently to this day has continued to try to pursue the truth of what happened to her son. But again, let's walk through this as best we can, Amir, about the steps in this story. So 6 weeks after Pat Tillman died, 5-6 weeks later, it's part of the truth comes out that he wasn't ambushed by the Taliban, that he died at the hands of friendly fire. But how, again, is that first version of the friendly fire story characterized, and what's missing?
Well, they characterized it as a fog of war, which and they basically expected the family to then go away. But this woman, Danny Tillman, as you mentioned, said, well, hang on, this something doesn't add up here. Why weren't we told this before? And also, the story isn't making sense. You know, there are certain elements that just didn't add up. And then the government made a very grievous mistake. They decided to hand over to the Tillman family a huge crate of documents, all of them totally redacted. There's no names, places. It's
redacted meaning blacked out.
That's right. In fact, some of these pages, I've seen these documents, sometimes an entire page will only be black. It's a page of black lines. And they never expected that that anybody could make heads or tails out of these documents. Well, Danny Tillman, at the time a teacher down in New Almaden near San Jose, would take these documents home every day after work, and she would just begin unredacting them.
Let's listen, actually, to a little bit more of your film that explains this. This is a clip from the film where, again, you'll hear the mother, Dani Tillman, talk about her digging through these thousands of pages of documents. The other voice you'll hear, and perhaps you can tell us a bit about him before we listen to this, is a man named Stan Goff, Amir, who was a blogger, a veteran, and who really became kind of an investigator along with Dani Tillman about what happened to Pat. But
yeah,
briefly,
I mean,
describe who Stan is.
He's only been a blogger in his most recent incarnation. What he really was of importance to the family was a special ops veteran. He's been in – I mean his CV is chilling. He's been in Somalia, Vietnam, Haiti, you know, all these – you know, he's overturned, you know, governments in Central America. He was in Pat's platoon years before Pat, but he's also been in Delta Force and all kinds of very shady operations.
But he, and because of that experience, sort of knew how to sort through some of this.
He had a kind of an aha moment sometime later in life, and is now a peace activist. And the family recruited him to help go through these 3,500 pages of documents.
Let's hear this next clip of the film then of Dani Tillman, Pat's mom, and Stan Goff.
We tried to look at what was being said, and then we try to piece together, okay, if they're saying this, then who might that be?
We would take a redacted name and we'd try to count the number of spaces that were in there to try to figure out whose last name was in there. And of course, by going over the same thing again and again with some names plugged in, we started to become familiar with aspects of it.
I want to make this very clear. When we initially heard of this fratricide and the fact that these soldiers in this vehicle had killed Pat, we felt very bad for them to have to live with this. We thought it was just some horrible, horrible accident. You know, they were in a fog of war, and they were frightened, and it was too dark to see. But you're reading things in the documents that make you very suspicious. The more that we heard about the situation, it seemed much more like gross negligence.
Again, that's Pat Tillman's mother, Dani, along with Stan Goff, an Army veteran who aided the family in its pursuit of the truth. So what's beginning to become clear at this point in the story is that, yes, it was friendly fire, but there might be something else going on.
Yeah, the government had characterized the event as having happened from 200 meters away, in the space of 4 seconds.
The lights bad.
The lights bad. They gave cover to these soldiers on the ground, but what Dani and Stan and the rest of the family were able to find out was that it was closer to 40 meters. And it wasn't 4 seconds. It was from a minute to 2 minutes, which, you know, you're on radio. That's an ungodly amount of time. That Pat had time to throw a smoke grenade to indicate that he was friendly, that the soldiers in the vehicle who fired at Pat admitted seeing friendlies on the ridgeline where they were firing.
So let's set the stage for the moments leading up to the death of Pat Tillman. There's a Army group that Pat is a part of. Their Humvee breaks down. And so there's a key decision made to split the group in two. Walk us through, Amir Barlev, what happened then, why that decision was made to split the group in two, and how that proceeded then to unfold.
Well, it was made it was a very, very bad decision to split the troops to begin with. And in fact, the platoon leader vehemently protested against this decision. He realized they had been sitting in this one village for 6 hours. Anybody who would be in the neighborhood, you know, Taliban fighters would have seen them. He actually was one of the people who was punished most harshly after the fact, even though he was one of the only voices of sanity in the whole story. But the platoon was split. Pat's half of the platoon went through this narrow chasm first, and then the second half of the platoon went through a little bit later. And while the second half was going through, an explosion or two was heard. And the soldiers in that second half of the platoon thought they were being under attack, and they began firing madly into the canyon walls above them. in investigations later, it was all these soldiers were asked what they saw, and there was a lot of ambiguity about whether or not they had even seen anybody firing at them. In fact, maybe one or two people may have fired at them and then ran away, fired at them from a great distance and then ran away. So the 20 Taliban fighters that the government reported and still maintains were part of this ambush have never been found. They began firing up into the canyon walls, and about 10 minutes later, they got to the end of the canyon where the first half of the platoon, including Pat, were stationed, who were actually running back because they heard the gunfire coming out of there and they wanted to help the second half of the platoon. And then the soldiers on this first truck came out of the mouth of this canyon and just began wildly shooting up the area there, and they shot for so long they ran out of bullets. But before that, they fired on Pat's position for a minute to 2 minutes. They actually even moved their vehicle to get a better aim on Pat. They got out of their vehicle. Meanwhile, Pat was throwing a smoke grenade, trying to indicate that he was friendly. And everybody in that first half was waving, saying, "Hey, you're firing at us! You're firing at us!"
We're going to be taking a short break in just a few minutes, so I want to save for after our break the next clips that we're going to hear about the sort of climactic moment. But in the time before we take our break, I want to just kind of widen out for a moment and talk about the importance of this story, because it's also easy, I think, to just point the finger at the military, and in many ways deservedly so, for the deceit that came as part of this story. But one of the things that your film also makes clear is that we all, to a degree, embraced certain myths. And we all wanted to believe in the square-jawed hero, whether it's those of us who read about it or those of us in the media who reported on it. Say something about that.
Sure.
And your motivation for wanting to make that part of the story too.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, because I think it's really a mistake if people, pin this whole thing on a handful of liars from the last administration. Of course, those people are culpable, but it never would have worked if it hadn't been for the press and for the culture at large, as you say. I mean, there's footage in our film. You mentioned Jessica Lynch. There's footage in our film that people are going to be absolutely shocked when they see. During the rescue, you can really hear that it was just a phony public relations stunt. You can hear the people, adjusting the camera and things like that. We got that footage from ABC, and it was part of the handout that the military gave to try and drum up this this phony story on Jessica Lynch. Why they didn't show that same footage that we show in the film is an outstanding question. It's because it didn't fit into this female Rambo hailing from West Virginia myth that they wanted to sell us.
And similarly with Pat Tillman, part of the argument that your film makes is that we wanted that story. Media may have wanted it, but we as a people wanted that story, and it was used in part to bolster the reason for why we were there.
Absolutely.
Amir Barlev, he's the director of a powerful new film called The Tillman Story. It opens in Berkeley, San Francisco, and San Jose today, by the way. It will be at the Landmark Shattuck Theater in Berkeley at the Century San Francisco Center 9 in the city, and at Cinema 7 Cinemas in San Jose, all opening today. When we come back, we'll talk more about the story, we'll hear more from the film, and we'll take your calls as well. Here's the number if you want to join our conversation and pose a question to director Amir Barlev. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Back with more of The Tillman Story in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Amir Barlev. He's the director of The Tillman Story, which opens tonight around the Bay Area. And let me just mention those theaters again. It's opening at the Landmark Shattuck Theater in Berkeley tonight. And Amir Barlev will be at the opening of the film at Berkeley this evening. Then it's Saturday. He'll also be at San Jose at 2:15 and 4:30. That's at Camera 7 Cinemas in San Jose. Amir will be at the 2:15 2:15 and 4:30 showing. And then also on Saturday in San Francisco at the Century San Francisco Center 9 Theater, Amir will be there along with one of the soldiers who's interviewed in the film and who we will hear from in just a moment, Russ Baer. So opening all throughout the Bay Area this weekend, Amir Bar-Lev at each of those showings, both today and tomorrow in the Bay Area. So let's go to the climactic moment now, and we're about to hear from one of Pat Tillman's good friends, Russell Baer, who was with Pat on that hillside, set the stage for what's happening, and then we'll hear what from Russell.
At that point, I thought we were all going to die. And I remember putting my weapon on fire and having my finger on the trigger and knowing that these are my buddies down there, but knowing that they're going to kill us and kill everybody. And I was, you know, a second away from just loading them up, just killing them all. And I could have done it.
Russ Baer on the hillside. So they all know who's shooting at them. There's no mystery from their point of view.
Well, there was no mystery really at all. And within 24 hours after this, as Kevin Tillman told us, everybody in Afghanistan except for him knew that it was friendly fire, because Kevin Tillman, Pat's brother, was in the rear vehicle of that second half of that convoy. And by the time he arrived, 10 minutes after the shooting, he was quarantined. His entire platoon had been ordered to lie to him, and they shuffled him with Pat's body away in a helicopter.
So Russell Baer, the friend of the Tillman brothers who we just heard from, who was on the verge of returning fire to his friends just because he wanted to, of course, save his own life, he was ordered not to tell the truth to Kevin Tillman.
Well, the entire platoon was ordered not to tell the truth to anybody. And Russ Baer ended up becoming an invaluable asset to the Tillman family later on. But, I mean, the story, you know, it really shows how one of the most egregious parts of this story is these people, these politicians and the brass who, you know, wrap themselves in the flag all the time unabashedly, they throw the soldiers under the bus. You know, there's a 3-star general in our film who was scapegoated. A few years later, they pinned the whole thing on him. He just happened to have retired. So it was a very convenient person for them to say was at fault for the entire escapade. But these guys, it's shameless, the disrespect that they show to these soldiers. And it started really at this moment.
I want to hear from one other soldier, and then we'll open up our conversation, take your phone calls as well. This is young man by the name of Brian O'Neill, who was befriended by Pat Tillman. Pat Tillman in some ways almost became, it feels like, a kind of big brother and mentor. Brian O'Neill is this smaller man, Pat Tillman, of course, the star athlete. And he kind of brought O'Neill along and protected him in some ways. And there they are on this hillside together at this moment where they're being fired upon, and young Brian O'Neill thinks that he's about to die, and here's what he said at that moment.
I started to say a prayer out loud, you know, and it was something like, oh God, please, if you can help us out of this situation, you know, I'll be very grateful, you know, and I'll do what I can, you know, to repay you for this debt that I will owe you. And I remember Pat saying, O'Neill, quit praying. You know, God is not the one to help you now. This is reality. This is what we need to focus on. I don't want you to go into some la-la land, not pay attention, and then get killed. I was actually grateful for him to say that. I was really trying to put my focus somewhere else and not keep it here. Pat, he saved my life.
Comments from Brian O'Neill, who was alongside Pat Tillman at the moment he died. And he died, we think, just moments after that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they were being fired on by, I think, 4 different weapons, one of them a 50 cal. And it's like that scene in Pulp Fiction where, you know, they shoot everything but the place where he is. I mean, it's probably a bad comparison, but I mean, it's Pat. They fired so many rounds at the rocks that they basically left just one place, and it was where that young man Brian O'Neill was sitting. And it's a, you know, it's one of the great tragedies is that they took Pat's actual heroism out of the story because it involved his atheism and saying, his act of heroism was to tell this kid, this Mormon kid, you got to stop praying, you got to be here. And those were some of the last words out of his mouth. Although actually the last words out of his mouth, you're going to get to it. Okay.
I want to save Pat's last words.
Very good.
If you don't mind.
No.
For a bit. Amir Bar-Lev, again, joining us, the film The Tillman Story, opening tonight around the Bay Area. We have lots of people who want to join our conversation. I promise I'll get to them in just a moment. But to just give one more beat to the story, there were then many investigations, three different military investigation, a criminal investigation. It took many, many years to come to the point of view that there was more here, that the Army had deceived the Tillman family and the American public. And yet you would also, I think, make the point, Amir Bar-Lev, that that story is still incomplete?
Oh, yeah. We haven't reached the last chapter because actually the government, the military have never admitted that there was any deception or anything deliberate about any of this. Time and time and again, they have said to the family, "We are so sorry. It was a series of mistakes, an almost perfect storm." Those are their words. A perfect mistake, a storm of errors, missteps, and misjudgments. They've characterized the whole thing as a kind of a Rube Goldberg of clerical bureaucratic errors. And the very disingenuous part of it is they always accompany that with a, you know, a hat in hand apology. So if you think that the story has ended, it's because the PR agents in the government have very smartly and carefully gotten this idea out there that we looked at it, we found mistakes, and we're apologizing for them. They have never admitted that they deliberately deceived the American people.
Seven people were disciplined. Some people were lowered in rank. Some people took pay cuts, including a 3-star general. Your argument, though, is that that doesn't go far enough and that while they were disciplined, there was never any criminal culpability. There was never anything that really got to the extent of the deceit.
Actually, only one person was really disciplined. The discipline of the other six was something like somebody told me that it was the same punishment you'd get if you forgot to clean your rifle. And then the one guy was already retired and they docked his pay a little bit. But, you know, what needs to happen and hasn't happened is for the government to admit they deliberately deceived us. And you know, the family has been really clear about this. The very first thing I ever heard Danny Tillman say at the congressional hearings when we met was, "This is not about Pat. This isn't about Pat." There's a sense out there that people are trying, that the family is sort of insatiable and they want justice for their son. What they want is for people who shamelessly lie to the country not to get away with it. It's the principle at stake. And so far, they have.
Let's hear from our callers. Marie joins us first from Pauling, New York on the Sirius Satellite Network. Marie, go ahead, please.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. I'm calling because I'm an OIF-1 combat veteran, and I'm really glad this story is getting attention. But, you know, I feel invested in pointing out that this happened so many times to so many people. And, you know, obviously the celebrity that goes with Pat Tillman gets this story special attention. You know, I lost a translator in very similar circumstances. You know, some soldier who had been in country for one day fired on a civilian vehicle that was behind his convoy, fired a 50 cal round through the guy's chest. And it was actually the vehicle of an Italian diplomat driving north. And my translator was serving as his translator. This happens every single day in Iraq and Afghanistan. Soldiers freak out because they hear some random noise and they're not trained appropriately to process and synthesize all of the information, all the stimuli appropriately, and decide whether they really need to fire a weapon. And people die, and it doesn't get any attention. And it breaks my heart that this happened to Pat Tillman, you know, that we lost a great soldier and a wonderful guy. And it happens all the time to civilians, to translators, to soldiers. And I'm just glad it's getting some attention.
Marie, thank you.
Yeah, well, I really thank you for the call, and I think you bring up a great point, and it's what I was trying to say before, which is, you know, this is not really about Pat. Danny and the rest of the family realize that, as you said, they they've been given special treatment in a way because we're a celebrity obsessed culture and they had a celebrity son. But in the process of doing this for 6 years, they've become kind of lightning rods for other families who have had similar things happen to them. And Danny Tillman, Pat's mom, is in touch with many of these moms who have heartbreaking stories. And in fact, they're kind of coalescing around the film right now. It's been very moving. In fact, I encourage you to go to our website, thetillmanstory.com. We also have a Facebook page, and that's where you'll see a kind of a forum developing of other people who have similar stories and who are trying to, you know, use Pat in a way to get some attention. And you know, this is something he would have liked to be used for because it's constructive, and make the point that this happens all the time. And it's not so much. I mean, of course, friendly fire is horrible. It happens much more often than we're told. But it's the lying also, the lying to the families, supposedly for their own good, but also for PR reasons.
Both you and Marie have mentioned the 50 cal, the 50 caliber weapon. For the uninformed, like me, what kind of weapon is that? Tell us what was going on that day, and by Marie's call, happens all the time.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a gigantic sized bullet. And, you know, one of the great, you know, parts of this, of the lie really was, in fact, unfortunately, it took off the bullets that fired on Pat. They beheaded him basically. It wasn't the 50 cal, it was a 240. But then 45 minutes later, in the field hospital report, it says CPR administered. And it says that because they wanted to be able to destroy Pat's uniform. They ended up burning his uniform, his vest, his diary. They wanted to destroy the evidence that he was killed by American rounds. And in order to burn something, you have to be able to say that the soldier was still alive. You can't – once a soldier is killed, his uniform becomes evidence. But they wanted to destroy this evidence, so they had to say that he was still alive in the field hospital. And again, the very first time I ever heard Danny Tillman speak, it was at the congressional hearing, and she said, "I would like to know why they said CPR was performed on my son when he didn't have a head."
Powerful stuff. Amir Bar-Lev again, the film, The Tillman Story. Let's hear from another caller. Joel in Berkeley is next. Joel, go ahead.
Hi, Amir. I'm actually a high school buddy of yours from chem class. I want to congratulate you on your success.
Thank you very much. Hello. And yeah, I'm a Berkeley boy, so I have hopefully...
Joel,
yeah,
I know Joel. Sandler.
Yeah. How you doing?
I'm doing well. First of all, I want to thank you for doing this story. It was something that, you know, I had followed as it was happening and followed the lies that were being, you know, told by our government. But I wanted to ask you personally how this has affected your views about, if you're willing to share, about the government and about war and combat in general. And then secondly, if you're willing to let us in on what you're working on next. I know this is just premiering, and I hope to be in the city tomorrow and see you. But I was wondering if you'd share with us what you're working on next.
Oh, well, thanks for asking, and thanks for calling, Joel. And, I mean, you know, I think this is a story it's hard to synopsize how it's changed me. I started this film 3 years ago, and I was single. And then now I have a wife and a kid. And so I see it different than when I started. I see it as a parent, I think. And really, I feel like it's a story. You know, it's nice to be here talking about it because I do see it as a parent in the Bay Area. You know, I think that this family, when people come see them, they're going to kind of see themselves a little bit. This is a family that has been used as a poster. You know, Pat's been used as a poster boy for something so different than he actually was. And that really is, you know, I mean, I started to see this as a kind of a Bay Area story, really. And I saw in Pat's upbringing some of my own upbringing. You know, of course, we're pretty different, but both families are prone to F-bombs. And Danny Tillman is, you know, the kind of mom that I think people are going to recognize a little of their own parents here in the Bay Area.
One thing that comes across so clearly in the film is the family's resentment about the way in which their sons' memory has been captured and used in a variety of ways different from who Pat Tillman really was. You see that from his brother who gets up in the middle of the funeral and says, "Kevin's dead. He's not with God. You know, cut all this stuff. That's not what he was about." You see the family's feelings that their brother, their son, has been sort of ripped away from who he was. And the source of particular resentment, it seems, from the family was the way in which a certain story was used to support a war that, as you suggest, Amir, Pat Tillman came to have grave doubts about. Just want to play one more clip. This is from his brother, Kevin. This is at a congressional hearing in 2007. This is Kevin Tillman, Pat's brother.
My name is Kevin Tillman. 2 days ago, I marked the third anniversary of the death of my older brother, Pat Tillman, Spear, Afghanistan. To our family and friends, it was a devastating loss. To the nation, it was a moment of disorientation. To the military, it was a nightmare. But to others within the government, it appears to have been an opportunity. A terrible tragedy was transformed into an inspirational message that served instead to support the nation's foreign policy wars.
Tell us more about the family's feeling about that. There are these powerful scenes in the film where you see Pat Tillman's jersey, a giant replica of his jersey unfolded at an Arizona football game. You see all of the celebrations, the jet fighters flying overhead the stadium and all of that, the justly deserved attention that he received and the emotional nature of this. And yet you also have this strong sense that the family felt like he was being taken from them and used for a purpose that was profoundly different from who he really was.
Well, they turned him into a cartoon character, really. And you know, there's a shot in the film that it goes by very quickly, but I've always saw it as a kind of a key to the whole story, especially with regards to how the family was treated and how Pat was taken from the family. You know, when a celebrity dies, there's the little impromptu memorial services memorials that, you know, people set up on the side of the road. Well, we have some footage of one of them in which you see somebody has written "our hero." And instead of underlining "hero," they've underlined the word "our," "our hero." And that's really what happened, is that people wanted to appropriate Pat. It's not just the right. I mean, I think that's an important point, is it's not just the military that tried to do this. It was everybody. You know, it was everybody kind of wanting a piece of Pat for themselves. And ultimately, you know, when his family said, when his brother said at that memorial service, "Pat's not in heaven, he's effing dead," it was because just before that, Maria Shriver had gotten up there and said, you know, and obviously well-meaning words, but she said, "Pat, your family doesn't have to worry anymore. You're home. You're safe." And it's kind of a grotesque thing in a way, because he's, you know, what they were worried about is exactly what happened, and he's not home and he's not safe. He's dead.
Martin in Santa Clara has our next observation. Martin, go ahead, please.
Yeah, this is a great topic, and very unfortunate the way things have played out. But one aspect that I'm wondering in terms of your film, or did you think about the malicious aspect of friendly fire, where certainly in Vietnam, my dad was in World War II in Korea, a lot of discussions about where maybe a commanding officer or even a fellow soldier really managed to get others upset within his organization and became the victim of friendly fire. Was any of that
I'm glad you ask it, and it'll take you about 2 seconds online to find any number of conspiracy theories that Pat was, you know, working with Noam Chomsky to blow the lid off the whole peak oil crisis or something like that. It's, you know, Stan Goff, that special ops operator that I mentioned earlier, said the military would like nothing more than for the argument to be between whether or not Pat was assassinated and their position, because it allows them to dismiss the whole, you know, the counter argument to theirs as, you know, conspiracy theory. There isn't any evidence really out there that Pat was assassinated. But on the other poll, it was not a fog of war. It was something more criminally negligent that people really need to come see the film to understand. But we didn't find any evidence out there that he, you know, was deliberately killed. But again, we also found that the story that's out there right now, that it was a confusing fog of war, is very, very far off the mark.
Martin, thanks for the call. Jim in San Francisco is up next. Jim?
Oh, hi. I'm glad to hear about the movie. Last year, I read the book that was published last year, and after reading it, my thought was deja vu, because back in the late 70s, There was a book called Friendly Fire that was later made into a made-for-TV movie about a family in Iowa whose son was killed by friendly fire during the Vietnam War and their ordeal that of seeking the truth. Did you hear about that one?
I haven't read it, but I have been told about it.
Yeah. Well, it's just been going on all this time. You know, it's just a fact of but you know what's the bad thing is the public always forgets, you know? We all forget about what happens, and it happens again.
Well, the government is counting on people to see this film and see Pat Tillman's story as kind of dredging up what happened, you know, 8 years ago, and it's time for us to move forward and things like that. And so I encourage people to prove them wrong because, you know, this film and the book that you mentioned and also Danny's book, Boots on the Ground by Dusk, you know, their attempts to counter the narrative that you got on CNN, that you got on ABC and the other networks. And so far, you know, those versions of the story have gotten a lot more play.
Jim, thanks for the call. Lori writes in, I saw the movie and I expected it to be a downer, but I actually found myself laughing in some places and really feeling for the family and the indignities they went through in both the over-the-top ceremonies and in the congressional hearing where they witnessed all those high-level generals utter the I don't recall statements. I thought the movie was really well done, and I wound up admiring Pat's mother and her tenacity. But one question I have is why Pat's brother did not participate in the film when all the other family members did. That's Pat's brother, Kevin, whose testimony before Congress we heard, but who was not interviewed in the film.
Yeah, Kevin helped us on background, but he didn't want to be interviewed. I mean, this is a family with a very healthy sense of their own privacy, and it's one of the most admirable things about them is they never wanted to be celebrities based on this tragedy, and they wanted the right story to get out there, but you know they're not interested in getting up there and pontificating about how much they miss Pat and kind of contributing to the hagiography that's happened to this point. But I'm also really glad that your emailer there mentioned that. It's if people are thinking that this film is 90 minutes of medicine that they kind of have to drag themselves to go see, I really encourage them to check it out because there are more laughs than they're expecting. It's a much more inspiring and uplifting story than you might think. Somebody said it was a story about the worst of our leaders and the best of our people. And the family, as evidenced by our R rating, the family is prone to things I can't say here on the radio. But, this is there are a lot of moments of levity and it's just a great family to spend 90 minutes with.
Shelley in Oakland is next. Shelley, go ahead, please.
Hi, Amir. I think 10 years ago on this day, we were on the playa together, and I just wanted to call and say both that we're really proud of you for making films and making films with such grace on such a difficult subject with such respect for our soldiers and their families. You've come a long way, baby.
Long way from the playa at Burning Man, I guess, yeah.
No kidding.
I'm actually speaking to you from the playa right now.
Oh, I would have expected.
Shelley, thanks. No. Thanks for the call. Sorry, go ahead if you have a quick question.
Yeah, I have a quick question. Amir, have you had a difficult time getting this film published and shown around the country and different parts of the country? Have you come up against roadblocks because of its subject nature?
Well, I know. I'm glad for the question. I think that, it's only in the movies that, the documentary filmmaker would get a bullet in his mailbox and some shadowy figure on the telephone saying, you better stop now. The military doesn't work that way. They have a team of publicists. The publicists make sure that, as I mentioned earlier, ABC and all the big networks report the story the way they want to. And they don't see a documentary as really registering. And I mean, it's going to sound like I'm groveling, and in a way I am. In order to prove them wrong, people need to come see the film and not see it on Netflix and not see it later and then register their anger on the Netflix comment boards. These films do struggle, and that's why the government doesn't have to worry about – doesn't really feel that they have to worry about them. So I encourage people to come out and see it in the theater.
And let's mention again where it's going to be shown. The film is going to be at various Bay Area theaters starting this evening. It's going to be at the Landmark Shattuck Theater in Berkeley at 7:25 tonight. Amir will be at that showing. Also at the Century San Francisco Center 9 Theater, Amir and Soldier Russ Baer, one of Kevin and Pat Tillman's friends, will be at that showing on Saturday. And it's also being shown in at the Camera 7 Cinema in San Jose. Amir will be at those showings at 2:15 and 4:30 tomorrow. In the end, despite all of the deceit that's revealed on the part of the military, I didn't come away from this film feeling that it was an anti-military film. That there is a degree, absolutely, of heroism in people like Pat Tillman and Kevin Tillman and Russ Baer and Brian O'Neill, and that this film honors that as well.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm glad you say that. We begin and end the film with a Neil Young song. And in the Neil Young song, it's called Hawks and Doves. And, you know, it's about the two sides of America, you know, the hawks and the doves. And and there's a line in there where he says, if you hate us, you just don't know what you're saying. And we put that song in there because, you know, we don't see this as an anti-American movie or an anti-military movie. It, like the way they characterize Pat Tillman, that's just too simplistic, and the truth is far more complex. And you know, as I said before, I think this makes you embarrassed. This story makes you embarrassed at times for our country, but it also makes you very proud that there are people like the Tillmans in it.
And if you would tell us Pat Tillman's last words.
Well, I can't actually hear on the radio because they involved a letter which got us an R rating. But I mean a word. But he said over and over again, "I'm Pat effing Tillman," and it's an amazing moment actually of foreshadowing. And of course, he had no way of knowing it. But seconds later, they would begin trying to turn him into somebody he wasn't. So that his last words were kind of a call to us from the dead, saying, you know, don't make me into somebody I'm not. I'm Pat effing Tillman.
Amir Bar-Lev, the director of the powerful new documentary, The Tillman Story. Thanks for being with us today. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer, Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.